This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Apex. His Twitter bio describes himself as the cartographer of the simulation, architect of post-America, man may not be replaced, archaeofuturism. Apex, great having you on.
Yeah, hi Robert. Thank you for having me. Really appreciate you doing this.
Yeah, look forward to it. And so you're a former leftist, and with the sphere... The Twitter sphere is, I'm not really sure what labels are. Kind of putting things in boxes can be a bit stifling, but there is this, I guess some people would describe it as the post-right sphere, and I'd say it's actually very different. I'm not sure if you were around back then, but very different than the right-wing sphere around in 2016. So if you want to kind of give some background information, your political evolution... you're a former leftist, and
Describe
your evolution, and then how did you kind of get to where you are now?
Yeah, perfect. Yes, I, for a very long time, I identified as just, you know, I don't know, say a run-of-the-mill leftist, but, you know, a pretty standard one. You know, back in high school, I was your typical teenage anarchy. We thought he'd figured out the world, and if, you know, people would just stop being stupid and get along, everything would be fine. Obviously, you grow out of that, and specifically the driver for my growth there was actually a blogger named Zippy. He blogged on a blog called Zippy Catholic. It was a WordPress blog. He unfortunately passed away in 2018. But he was a pretty big driver for me to realize that...
So this was 2018. This was after the kind of fall of what was referred to as the alt-right, like all these events like Charlottesville, and then the 2016 Trump movement. You never were associated with any of that stuff?
Yeah, no. Around 2016 for me was... I was... still kind of in the, still in the left, but coming
for,
to terms
a Bernie
like,
supporter?
No, I was pretty, I really wasn't invested in the election. I'm going to be entirely honest. I thought Donald Trump was entertaining. I liked the memes, but I was never too deeply involved. I wasn't like a political activist or anything. I didn't register people to vote or whatever. I mean, I was a freshman at uni in 2015 in the fall. So 2016 spring, 2016 fall, I was still pretty young. I didn't really get involved in anything, but for me, those years were more of a kind of a grappling with, you know, I had encountered Zippy in 2015, and it was kind of a grappling with, okay, it seems as if my understanding of the world is deeply misguided, that I just kind of adopted these frameworks because they felt nice, they sounded nice, and now I had someone who had really drilled down into them in language that also was not this super theoretical or philosophical language. It was, you know, very approachable to an 18-year-old. And I was like, okay, well, this is interesting. And, you know, obviously when your views get challenged at first, your instinct is to turtle. And I did, but you know, oh, it was like it scratched a part of my brain. So most of 2016 for me was spent on different parts of the internet, on WordPress blogs and kind of engaging. Discord was a big one. You know, I think it had just launched in 2015, and I got onto it in 2016 and in early 2016. And you know, back then there was it was still a bit of a vibrant platform for debate, and there were lots of people from all over the place. And so that was really where I hung out. I didn't really pay attention to, you know, what I guess we could refer to as the alt-right at the time. I wasn't really in the know. I think I probably saw the memes 2 or 3 weeks later than everyone else. But overall, 2016 came and passed. And over time, as, you know, I started identifying as what I would call a post-liberal leftist, which effectively could be summed up as saying that the principles of the left had become so abstract and unmoored from reality that they no longer served as any kind of real ethical grounding, that, you know, this abstract idea of freedom or of harm or even of consent had kind of morphed into these ideas that no longer justified anything on their own, and effectively were almost like emotional bludgeons that were used, you know, to support whoever was in power. It was almost as if we'd returned to might makes right. And truthfully, I think, you know, however much leftists liked to think we were rebels, we weren't. We were the ones in power. You know, and one of the more difficult realizations is that the system of social relations that the left supports is the exact substrate, the exact ground that is required for, that demands capitalism. And I think that's one of those moments where I was kind of like, okay, well, this isn't going to work. And over time, I mean, I think that the 2016 to 2020 period, and especially even the last couple of years, was really one of those eye-opening moments in just the sheer hysteria and the derangement, the complete lack of connection between people's reactions and what was actually going on. And more I drifted away from the left, not on philosophical matters. I mean, that break had already happened, but really on personality matters, this kind of dehumanization of people who voted for the wrong person. And it was very disturbing. And really, you know, my final break was the 2020 election, where right afterwards, the amount of joking, it kind of crossed the line where it wasn't really joking anymore of, you know, oh, well, the Hispanics voted for Trump, so yeah, they can all get deported now, we don't really care. The almost instrumentalization, like turning people into voters and nothing more. And you see this quite recently in so much of the Afghanistan discourse. I mean, you know, even when people try to hide it under the number of people who genuinely care about this from a humanitarian perspective is vastly lower than the number of people who are pretending to care simply in order to gain some upper edge, either in the ballot box or labor wages or however. So that was kind of my final break. And now, I mean, I think I probably, I have a pretty decent balance of people who follow me, but, you know, and I think I probably hang out more with the right or the post-right, or whatever you want to call that sphere of Twitter, simply because, ironically, it's more welcoming of an atmosphere.
Like, right now, yeah. It does seem like there's a switch of the left now is similar to a lot of conservatism of the 90s, the Bush era, and then the right now has elements of the left from the past. Like, obvious examples being, it's not totally perfectly matched, but you do kind of see that trend, free speech, anti-war, even some economic issues.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that in a lot of ways, the left has, as it took power, it took power partially because it had become liberal, and it taking power only intensified and entrenched the liberalism. And in response, you know, the friend enemy rules the day, and the right kind of started just turning against that. So it, you know, it ended up looking like some of those earlier movements. I mean, I feel as if, you know, the left is just, it, you know, there's this constant tone policing, and no one can have a moment of levity. And you know, I mean, I criticize the left very, very severely on the grounds that it has given up any sense of morality, and in that vein, actually demands commodification. It, you know, I use the phrase crypto hyper capitalists to describe what they are. They don't admit to it. They'll refuse to acknowledge it if you tell them that. They'll attack you for it, but that is what they are.
So yeah, for my writings on my Substack, I plan on writing a lexicon for alt-centrism, but you use a lot of these different terminology. Are you going for a more kind of elite audience, or do you want your writings to be understandable in more layman's terms for, say, normies, or just kind of dissidents or midwits? Or are you going for a more elite audience, and how you describe these different concepts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the goal is, of course, to be able to explain it to anyone. Any particular piece might be geared towards a different group, or just any subset of the audience. But overall, you'd want it to be approachable to everyone. I think it's certainly something that I can struggle with. I think that every writer will over time develop their own vocabulary, the way they like to say things, and people who aren't familiar with it may struggle to
to understand the buzzwords. So I have my buzzwords like panenclavism, and you have systems, and you do explain them, but if someone stumbles across an article, I could see how either yours or my articles, they could get a bit confused. So but with systems, this goes beyond just the political system of government. You're more actually talking about, you have a lot of themes, systems and agencies, systems, how they're reshaped via shifts, ability to shift systems. But this actually goes beyond just a government or a political system. You're talking about social systems as well. And if you want to kind of explain that in more detail.
Yeah, I mean, I think that obviously at this point, you know, you can be sure people can point to some tiny little political philosopher from the 20th or the 18th or the 16th century and say there are the solutions. But like, political philosophy at this point is bunk. It's exhausted. It's worn out. My goal primarily is to develop a kind of, this sounds so stupid and cringy, but like a meta-political philosophy, a step between politics and ethics, and that will include some kinds of ethical discussions. It'll include sociology. It'll include some political stuff. But you're talking, you know, about an interdisciplinary approach, you know, whether it's urbanism, education, all of that, into a system that understands healthy societies at a level somewhat above politics. And so one of my biggest issues is reductionist theories. And so
yeah, that would include,
you know, when,
class reductionism, faction of the left, like even like the dirtbag left, is they are an ally against woke neoliberalism, but I've written about this too. They have their own flaws.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't really engage the dirtbag left just because, you know, I don't really like them personally. But I think that, well, you know, both of us will refer to, you know, that constellation of thinkers that are disparagingly called post-left, and whatever their label is, you know what I mean. And there's that group of thinkers and the, you know, the class first and all of that stuff. And, you know,
I would say the same for those, well, obviously the case for reductionism, like at free markets, that can solve everything. That's obviously the case. But I'd also say that for those on the right, so identity is important, but then some people say like there's also race reductionist on the right and on the left.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I'd say it's a holistic approach. All of these issues matter as far as identity politics, but reductionism is definitely oversimplistic, but it's better to take a holistic approach. Like how do you connect all these different aspects? Because there's all these identity versions of identity politics, gender, that go beyond individualism. There's gender, religion, there's class, there's race, there's age, all these different things. And it gets very complex, like basing your entire identity on one thing, but you have to take a holistic approach. And I guess you can't just, like, I think you wrote a Substack about this, you can't just reject or ignore identity politics. It is going to be, because people form tribes, and that's how they gain social capital and political power.
Yeah, I mean, so you know, I think I wrote in that piece, you know, all politics are identity politics. It's effectively that, you know, you have this objective or external or whatever you want to call it, set of relationships or roles. It's like, however you feel about it, you are some person's child, you are some person's parent, you are a worker or an owner or some combination of the two. You live in town A, not town B. And all of these things provide incentives. They provide incentive structures. But what I feel like so many people fail to, you know, look at, either because they don't, it's harder to model, or they get, you know, they want everything to be scientifically optimizable, is that people have different subjective weights on those objective interests. And being able to shape the weights of other people is both empirically, you know, we know this happens. We know that the people who have the power to shift narratives are capable of shifting how people, you know, what roles do people align with or feel most strongly about. And so, you know, when we're looking at this, we have to understand all of these different roles and all of the different roles an individual may care about, and then look at, you know, the narrative producing and propagating institutions and how they're shaping things. I mean, these things are shaped via power. We know this. I mean, even something as banal as advertising is aware of this. It is aware of shaping how we perceive ourselves, how we perceive the world, what is or isn't important, what roles should be followed, how to identify. I mean, we know this, and we know that it has power.
Yeah,
I mean,
politics, like, people have their own needs, like economic, political, social, even psychological. But all those needs, even if they're, a lot of them are subconscious too. And I wrote about that in my alt centrist article, but they all relate to some form of identity politics. No one's like a pure autonomous individual.
Yep. And so it's, you know, the whole point of those pieces was, you know, or I guess not the whole point, but a point of those pieces was to really emphasize the importance of agency, you know, and of understanding that individuals do shape systems. They're shaped by them, but they do shape them, and they're not wholly defined by those systems. And so, you know, that was, you know, even from my early days, it was one of the concerns I had with the left, is this far too system based thinking.
They're social systems, but one thing I've noticed about the modern left is they're really big on empowering institutional, top-down, centralized institutional power.
Well, I mean, I think that when you perceive the world as lacking any kind of agency, then that just naturally flows. I mean, it's a problem. And then, you know, you combine that with like this love of convenience and optimization and all of that, and you end up getting a very anti-human ideology. You know, and you know, there's a lot more in common between the left and neoliberals than I think that they would like to admit to themselves. And that was, again, a major driver of why I left the left. Is it just wasn't something that I could, you know, support any longer. And, you know, I mean, there's, I still will policy-wise agree with the left on quite a lot of things, but, you know, the philosophy is very different, and some things you just can't salvage. And I think that, you know, if you're asking, you know, how do you build a healthy society? How do you build a good society that helps people live good lives? You know, I don't think that the like autonomy is a precondition of virtue. I will say that. You know, you need the ability to make your own decisions without being coerced in order to have even a chance at being a good person. And at the same time, you know, it's a precondition, yes, but it's not the condition of what is virtuous or not, and it can't serve as that. You know, there is right, there is wrong, and I think that, you know, if you want to build a society that allow, you know, that treats everyone with dignity and respect, and helps people really develop as people, and develop morally, and develop their talents, and, you know, really add and live the best life they can, I think that you need a much more substantive moral grounding. And the left appears to refuse to do that. It could do that, but it appears to refuse to do that. And so I think that, you know, when we start talking about systems and agency and all of that, you know, you're kind of in this meta politics or post politics or whatever you want to call it. You know, these discussions in which you're really trying to ask a question that is one foot in the realm of ethics and one foot in the realm of politics, and is going, okay, how do I build a healthy society? What does that mean? And that's really, I think, that the kind of project that's lacking. I mean, there's plenty of aesthetic projects on the right. There's plenty of, you know, there's a handful of leftist theories. There's, you know, plenty of other dissident spaces across the spectrum. I mean, your alt-centrism is one of those, that you know, clearly has a bit of a following. And so, you know, there's pockets of vibrancy, but so much of it is still accepting these false starters, these false assumptions. And you know, you really have to engage more substantively with that ethical grounding if you want to be able to escape from, you know, this exhausted world that we live in.
So that is the objective of any system, political or social, is to provide as many people as possible with just a decent quality of life. And all the major political ideologies have basically they've failed at that, and the system as a whole. But yeah, looking at like social atomization is a it's a social crisis and a product of a lot of different things. Some could even blame it on an era of extreme prosperity, some ideological factors, and a lot of it is just technological change, even technological progress. And you have the discussion from Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone, but it is so embedded, like the system that we have now. It does seem like that is a fundamental, there's something fundamental about this the system that causes this atomization, and you do kind of get to both, it relates to economics and social issues, because looking at the social conservatives versus social libertarians, and I never really was a fan or supported the kind of the GOP type wedge issue social conservative policies, and I've been more kind of a socially liberal on many issues, and I have seen the conservative movement under Trump actually where social conservatism and evangelical politics actually waning in favor of more social libertarianism. So I never really identified as a social conservative, but I think the best argument that you can make against social liberalism, beyond just like the wedge issues, is that idea of radical autonomy just leading to atomization.
Yeah, I think it's important, you know, to note that that, you know, obviously the right and left have been very diverse spheres of thought for a very long time, and at least, and I don't know, I feel like it was a fairly major strain of thought for a while, but I feel as if many on the left, especially when I was on the left, understood some degree of substance to those ethical groundings beyond autonomy.
Because there are arguments you can make. So take an issue like drug legalization, and I am sympathetic to that argument because there are countless arguments against the war on drugs, or there are legitimate arguments for gay rights. So there are legitimate arguments you can make for socially liberal stances. Just the key flaw is when it gets to that point of radical individual autonomy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I one of the first things that I wrote seriously a number of years back, and it was very poorly formulated then, and I improved it over time, but, you know, was like a non-liberal defense of gay rights, and a non-liberal defense of prison reform. And so, you know, there are certainly ways, this is what I meant, you know, the idea of a post-liberal left, the left has a way out. Will it
take
it?
I don't know. So is it sort of similar to the point I made in my alt-center article that I'm calling for incorporating its left-wing policies that may be left-wing, but without the philosophical basis of the left?
Yes, that is pretty much exactly what I'm referring to. And, you know, I think that there are, and obviously people are going to disagree with me, and I think that's fine. You know, part of the metapolitical project is that, you know, I mean, I've had people who go like, I dislike the leftists who engage with your work, or I dislike the right wingers who engage with your work. And it's like, well, yeah, you know, but the idea of a metapolitics is that it's neither left nor right. It's establishing a firmer ground in which then the left and right can grapple. You know, in the same way that the left and the right were both birthed from a liberal framework or a proto-liberal framework, you know, with the French Revolution. Just as that, you kind of need, I mean, hopefully not nearly as bloody as the French Revolution. That would be horrifying. But you need a metaphorical one. You need a new ground that a new left and right can kind of be birthed from. And so, you know, I think that you and I, you know, when I was reading your articles, I think you and I probably, you know, compared to the people that we engage with on Twitter, you and I probably swing further left on at least on a number of social issues.
Yeah, I'd say, I guess it depends. Because,
it depends, yeah, it depends.
Who I'm associated with. I have associated with more progressive causes, but I would say among my political sphere and among the people who I interact with, who follow and retweet me and interact with on Twitter, I'd say that I'm actually more left-wing than maybe 70 or even 80%. At least 70% of them. So that does show you that you might have left-wing stances, but there's certain litmus tests that force you to align with more right-wing people, because I'd say even though I have left-wing stances, the people I align maybe feel like forced to align with are more on the right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I always chuckle whenever I post, like, one of my results from one of those, like, political compass or political values.
Well, I posted mine, I got centrist, but slightly closer to the left, and I kind of joked, like, isn't that, like, basically the same as, like, Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton, so that makes it, I don't know, it seems pretty superficial then.
Yeah, but it's a radical centrism,
yeah,
my dude,
exactly.
Radical centrism. I mean, I always consistently get, you know, pretty substantially on the left, and people, you know, are always surprised at that. I mean, I think that, you know, the problem is, you know, there are litmus tests that are political and there's litmus tests that are personality-wise. It's just kind of like, all right, if you can't take a joke,
we're
then
also
I'm out of here.
Because a lot of, yep. A lot of politics is these aesthetic preference to tribes.
Yep. It's all aesthetic and sentiment. I think that, you know, when you're looking at this, it's kind of, the question is, you know, how do you build that, you know, morally substantive ground? And then a new left and right can be birthed from that. So I think that, you know, you and I both understand, you know, the need to balance, or at least this is part of what I got from reading a few of your articles and engaging with you on Twitter, you know, is understanding the need to balance, you know, individual subjectivity with the need for community involvement and embeddedness and all of that kind of stuff. You know, I think that we agree plenty on those kinds of areas.
And kind of with this idea of a radical center, one of the critiques that I hear is, I forget who coined it, but the idea that if something is not explicitly right wing, that it goes, that it ends up shifting to the left. I understand
Hulu
that.
Hulu always swims left, yeah. That's
I don't endorse that, but I sort of get that, and I counter that argument by putting forth some core principles and kind of like a dissident center syncretic politics that fuses the left and the right. I'm not really sure if it's like going to take off. It could take off, but it's hard to say. And it also kind of relates to the slippery slope fallacy. It is relevant to like that vision for a dissident center. So take social issues, social conservatism, that's kind of the example. And I guess one of the really kind of, it's insane, but also kind of sad, is they recently in D.C., they arrested this, like, right-wing domestic terrorist, and they have a video of him speaking, and basically, he's throwing his life away by engaging those kind of, that criminal behavior, but in the clip, he's basically, has a pretty pro-establishment stance, like, he's for a colorblind anti-racism, but a hawkish foreign policy. He's sort of like a establishment conservative. People on Twitter are kind of talking about that. It is pretty sad, but it is like the cliche of conservatives adopting the political stances of liberal social values of liberalism from the 80s and 90s. And
I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's what it is.
Most conservatives
are
right liberals.
Yeah, they're right liberals. So, and also kind of the slippery slope fallacy. It applies to economic arguments as well. So one example is populist conservatives they'll say that they're sort of like, you have populist conservatives that are engaged in class war, but at the same time they're opposed to taxing billionaires because it's a slippery slope to Marxism. So yeah, that's a slippery slope fallacy. But I do think I do call for fusionism of the left and the right. Yeah, there does need to be some agreed upon core principles to either prevent the slippery slope fallacy or for just a really kind of shallow, watered down version of what conservatives have become.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the idea that Cthulhu always swims left is very much a historically contingent observation. You know, I mean, it's just like the left has power, whether it wants to admit that or not. And so unless your institution has greater cohesiveness and can withstand external attacks and maintain that cohesiveness, it's going to fall apart. You know, so that's how I read it. And that's true for any institution. You know, I mean, if the left wants to, if some portion of the left has an epiphany and decides to stop being secret hyper-capitalists and actually go beyond, you know, individual autonomy and really develop a substantive pro-worker philosophy, then, you know, they'll be faced with the same dilemma, which is, you know, your institutions have to be more cohesive and more demanding on its members than the enemy ones. And, you know, it's very rare to have good institutional design. You know, it's something that I've been trying to explain and investigate, but it's very difficult to do that. And so, you know, I think that you end up getting, you know, conservative ink, which I think I mentioned this, you know, to you before, which is, you know, the obsession with procedure, with claiming neutrality, or, oh, it's a private business, or, you know, they can do what you want. I mean, Rand Paul got kicked off of YouTube.
Principles over actually having a plan to succeed.
Yeah, but and it's not even like, you know, the idea is, oh, you either have these principles or you have no principles. It's like, you should have different principles, you know? Like, there's, these principles are clearly, you know, backwards and wrong. I mean, obviously something has gone horribly, horribly wrong here. You know, in our understanding of public versus private, and our understanding of free speech, of the public square, of corporations, and, you know, many things have gone horribly wrong. And so you end up getting, I think, almost a terror at the idea of imposing, you know, the idea that, oh, well, I don't want to impose myself on others. You're always imposing yourself on others. Every, you know.
Oh, yeah, like the kind of, it's like the non-aggression principle.
Yeah, it's all nonsense. A morality is always being imposed. If it's not imposed by the state, it's imposed by a group of powerful institutions that are given a pat on the back by the state and allowed to impose their will. Like, it doesn't, the powerful are always imposed against. The question is, are you going to have principles, or are you going to work on a procedure that effectively reduces to might makes right? It's like, congratulations, after 2,500 years of political philosophy, you're back with the ancient Greeks. Thucydides would be proud. You know, it's a very big problem, and you know, you kind of gotta look at these groundings, and so, you know, I think that there's room. I think that there's room to convince people, but, you know, you really have to let go of a lot of the allegiances to certain principles. I mean, you know, on the left, you need to let go to this idea of quote unquote equality, because that idea doesn't mean anything, and generally what it does mean is something deeply inhuman. And on the right, you really need to let go of, like, this idea of, you know, of capitalism, of you know, the idea that this system is somehow more free. You know, it's just as bureaucratic, it's just as managerial, it's just as centralized.
You make the point, like, the left are, they're actually hyper-capitalists.
They're hyper-capitalists.
They're a product of hyper-capitalism. They're not classical. Like, I'm not a Marxist, but the left are not.
But even Marx, I mean, I would go so far as to say that Marx can be read, because, you know, he has a huge corpus of thought and contradicts himself quite a bit, but he can be read as either a non-liberal humanist of, you know, the Renaissance, not Renaissance more, but like Enlightenment era humanism, or he can be read as a liberal. He can be read as a liberal. And I think that most people, especially in the post-World War II era, in which, you know, liberalism has certainly been utterly triumphant, I think that most people read him as such. And you, even people who identify as a classical Marxist tend towards that reading. Or they tend towards a very mechanical analysis of society and then claim that they can't do any, you know, everything else is idealism or whatever. And so, you know, even these classical Marxists are many times, you know, they're hyper-capitalists. I mean, all that is solid melts into air has ironically been facilitated by the very people who, you know, read that line and thought it meant something. You know, the Marxists themselves have dissolved many of the obstacles to capital's continued dominance in the
world. Yeah, like they're both, both the Marxist side and the capitalist side, they're both totally managerial, and you kind of look at the
managerial
argument,
they're bureaucratic,
yeah,
they
the
commodify
that
things.
There's no such thing as a private company because corporations are backed up by the state and by central banks. But even though, like, I actually have heard libertarians make that argument, but then they'll get really, they'll say, oh, but free markets have not been tried. They will acknowledge that corporations are a product of state regulation, but their vision obviously is not going to work. It's not going to work either. My economic views are more nuanced. I'm not far left economically. I have a more kind of nuanced stance, but you do need a degree of state power in the economy. And I guess you would say, like looking at capitalism and the division of ownership versus absentee ownership, are you generally, how would you describe your economic theory? Would you say you're generally sympathetic to distributism?
Okay, yeah, so well, first I would say that, you know, the guiding principle is, for me, you know, understanding that economics is embedded in politics, which is embedded in ethics. Markets are not good in and of themselves. There was, I forget who, I, you know, it was actually, I think it was a liberal, but Amartya Sen, that was his name, you know, formalized the you know, the paradox that, you know, a perfectly efficient market can lead to social problems. A market working, markets rarely work, and when they do, it's rarely good. I think that was the phrase that was used. So, you know, understanding that markets and economics broadly is a tool, you know, to be used to help bring about the good life, to help bring about a healthy society, and to help maintain that healthy society. So when it comes to the ownership side, I'm, you know, I would say that I'm sympathetic to distributism, but, you know, put most clearly here is that my opposition largely is to two things, which is, one, to absentee ownership. I think that the moment that ownership becomes unmoored from labor is the moment capital accumulation just completely runs out of control. You know, and that sets you on a terminal path to destruction, either through ecological destruction, because you expand faster than you can maintain yourself. And I mean, you know, just look at America's soil quality and look at the air of the world. I mean, even our animals are getting fatter. I mean, it's not just corn syrup. Like, our soil is literally less nutritious than it was before. And I think that, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, land, labor, capital, these things need to be unified. I mean, and I point to, actually, you know, I originally got this view not from Marx or even Chesterton or Belloc. I got it from Smith. You know, I mean, Adam Smith writes in The Wealth of Nations. He does I wouldn't call it rudimentary, but it's certainly not on Marx's level or Weber's level.
There's a kind of economic theory where it's not Marxist or left wing, but the belief that economics should be based upon something tangible. So labor goods, as opposed to usury or managerialism. I'm not sure if that would be just distributism, but that's a way of thinking.
It's I wouldn't say it's necessarily distributism per se. I certainly oppose usury broadly. I think, you know, inflation should be zero. We need massive deleveraging. Certainly I would say that, you know, if someone held a gun to my head, it was like, pick one economic system that's probably the closest to what you believe, it would probably be distributism. But really, for me, you know, reading The Wealth of Nations cover to cover, I had to do that twice in uni. It's a big freaking book. But one of the things that really stuck out to me was Smith's class analysis, in which he notes that there's a couple points in the book. In one part of the class analysis, he says that the interests of the laborer and the landlord are aligned with the interests of society, that as society's prosperity increases, you know, labor and land benefit from this. But that capital is that's not actually the case. And on the other side, he notes that, you know, laborers are hardworking, but, you know, they don't look to the future. Capitalists look to the future, but they're kind of lazy, and landlords are just scum. That's effectively what he writes. And for me, you know, Smith then proposes what he calls the independent workman. The independent workman, that is the phrase he uses, is an individual who owns their own labor, owns their own capital, and owns their own land. So think of it as like a farmer who owns their own tools and land. They don't have a bank loan or anything, and they sell that. There's no surplus value. There's, you know, all of the interests are aligned with society. And so, you know, with absentee ownership, what you get is you get capital accumulation at the expense of general well-being. I mean, you need a system of competition. You need a system that drives efficiency. That's true. But you also need to make sure that the system is working towards the general good of society. I mean, this is it's just an assumption in Smith. I mean, most people don't realize that the free market and the assumptions that are aligned with it.
It's kind of bizarre because Smith was the father of capitalism, but he actually sounds closer to distributism. He sounds in some ways closer to like Chesterton and Bellick than he would sound like Ronald Reagan.
I mean, if you take a couple assumptions, if you take a couple assumptions that aren't too out there for economics, Smith and Marx are effectively advocating for very similar systems, you know, in terms of what they're looking at. But most people don't realize that Adam Smith was very much influenced by David Hume and Francis Hutcheson, okay, and more specifically, or more broadly, I suppose, opposite of specifically, more broadly, he was influenced by deist metaphysics, and the idea of deist metaphysics that emerged in the Enlightenment is the idea that there was a creator, but, you know, modern deism is like, oh, there was a creator, he created the world, and then he kind of just fucked off, you know. And that wasn't actually what deism was. Deism believed in a much more substantial ideology, or metaphysics, which was that the creator had actually fine-tuned everything in the universe to work harmoniously. That if only people could just kind of, you know, do what is, like, things naturally work in harmony. And this is an assumption. It is a metaphysical assumption. And yet that metaphysical assumption passed itself down through Hutcheson and Hume to a lesser extent, but very much Hutcheson, into Smith, and remains a core assumption in so many people's worldviews. That if you just let things flow, if you let the market work, it'll naturally lead to the greatest prosperity. Obviously, we know this is bullshit. Deist metaphysics were nonsense. They were broken down centuries ago. And in the same way, these ideas of a harmonious market are equally nonsense. You know, so but really, you know, you're looking at an individual who is even Adam Smith is recognizing the problem with absentee ownership. And you know, if you want to just do a basic rudimentary class analysis, incentive structures, I think that absentee ownership is a massive problem. And I think that what
do you think
you end up
with
getting,
economic theory, incentivization is a key point, because if you kind of look at, like, there is the kind of like basic bitch kind of like boomer conservative mentality of like pull yourself up from your bootstraps, and that people are just lazy, but that doesn't take maybe some you could say maybe in some cases that could be true, partial truth, but that doesn't take into account incentivization. And my economic, I've written a lot about that, my articles on economics and alts and dissident centrism, but I think both Marxism and hypercapitalism don't place a strong enough emphasis on incentivization and how to manage that.
Yeah, I would say that most capitalist theories don't, they ignore power more than incentivization. I think that they come up with very, you know, I mean, you know, you know, you have these people who think microeconomics is a science when it's less robust than astrology is, you know, or game theory. I mean, you have a lot of work on incentives. It's just that the work is wrong because it's starting from completely false presumptions about the world and about individuals. And, you know, the most fundamental law of economics is not supply and demand. It's market power. It's always been market power. When the king came up to your house and was like, buy this bread, and he has a bunch of knights with swords behind him, you buy the bread. You know, I mean, supply and demand is created by those with power. You know, yeah, there's limits, but the limits are a lot broader than people give it credit for. And so, you know, I think that, you know, I think that the boomer side is very much sentiment. There's a perception, and sometimes a rightfully so perception, that, you know, other people aren't working as hard enough. And you know, obviously it's extremely simplistic and it misses a lot. And it's wrong in most cases.
Looking at political power and the overall power structure, you kind of hear these like two sides. So some people are saying we're witnessing an institutional collapse. Then some are saying there's like a consolidation of power. And then looking at kind of these different trends, like some people are saying that what's going on in Afghanistan right now is a humiliation to the American empire and American system, and that there's also kind of a use of hard power, like a crackdown on civil liberties that's going on right now under the Biden administration, just as it's symbolic that soft power has failed. And then these other kind of factors, like elite over production and fragmentation of the elite. So I'm hearing a lot of, like, you have the acceleration mindset, but I'm hearing a lot of contradictory points. So is your overall assessment that elite power and establishment power is consolidating or fragmenting and fragile?
I actually think it's both. So I think that there is a humongous gap in theorizing power, which is confusing and conflating two very distinct things, which is power and fragility. If you've played a card game, if you've played Yu-Gi-Oh, you understand that a card has an attack and a defense. If you've played CSGO, you probably heard the phrase a glass cannon. You know, there's a very significant difference between power and fragility, which is power is the ability to, you know, compel others to do as you wish. Sure. Fragility reflects how robust is the system to defection. You know, I can have a very powerful system that fails the moment one person turns their back. I can have a very powerful system that's simultaneously quite robust, which is that you can't just have one. You can't even just have a majority. You need like 80-90% of people to defect before it actually breaks. And so you know, you can have a weak system that's very robust. You can have a strong system that's extremely fragile. And so I actually wrote a piece called Neoliberalism is Dead, Long Live Neoliberalism, which
And even with that term, like, I use neoliberalism in my articles and on my podcast, but I think as a buzzword, it's sometimes overused and not well-defined,
Well-defined. You know, I mean, it's kind of like fascism in that. Mussolini wrote something called The Doctrines of Fascism. Friedman wrote, I forget what it was called. He literally defined neoliberalism in a paper. Like, it's a well-defined, very concrete thing. And I'm certainly guilty of overusing it.
But it can also be used to describe different things. It can mean like radical individualism and radical free markets. But it can also
Globism,
mean just like a standard, like a standard kind of establishment Democrat type, who's woke but kind of centrist economically. So there's no definition.
So it's one of those things where I think. You know, you have a system that is still strong. You know, I conceptualize it this way, that you have brute power structures, okay? You have these brute facts of life. But laid on top of them is an ideology that supposedly justifies the existence of these hierarchies, that says, okay, these hierarchies are fine because X, Y, and Z, you know? The Pope is supreme because the Pope is you know, speaks for God. I'm probably messing that up theologically, and I apologize to a Catholic who's listening. But you know, you have these ideas like the king was given a divine right, therefore the hierarchy is justified. And what you're seeing right now is that the brute power structures are still pretty much there. They haven't like rapidly decayed. The decay was already there. In the 2000s and the 90s, it was revealed during the Trump era. It wasn't generated. So, you know, is there a degree to which power is weakening? Maybe, but really, you know, power appears to me to be fairly strong. The brute power structures, but the ideology that lays on top of them is just ripping apart at the seams. You know, it's just tearing itself apart, and what you're seeing is you're seeing people align themselves with almost pure authority, with the pure brute power structure, in a new form. You know, a new form of authority is kind of ossifying right now, and it certainly is not a good thing. And so, you know, I think that you have a system that is strong, but also fragile. And I think that the United States and the West broadly is more fragile than people give it credit for. And I think that part of the reason why it's not, you don't see problems is, you know, I think it's one of the reasons why I have sympathy towards those who say that, you know, it's, you're not looking at material decline, but clearly there has to have been some kind of spiritual decline in the West over the last 50 years, which is there's no movement.
It feels more like a stagnation or maybe a managed decline, but it doesn't feel like a full-on, it's not a collapse, that's not really...
Well, yeah, I mean, collapses are not these spectacular events. It's kind of like slowly and then all at once. I mean, I think that you're looking at a gradual but intensifying, especially post-2008, impoverishment of large swaths of the American people.
Like the Roman Empire took, it took 200 years to fall.
Yeah, it's,
so
it's not,
you could have a collapse that could last a century or more.
I mean, I think that, you know, I'm a big fan of Virilio and the idea of speed, and obviously, you know, what has happened now is, you know, everything moves so much faster, and so, you know, I don't think that there is a managed decline, because I don't think that anyone is trying to to manage a decline of a system. I think that people are acting according to their incentives, and it's just not
Yeah, I don't
working because the
think that,
incentives are
like,
built
I
poorly.
reject the conspiracy theory view that
Yeah.
everything is all like top down from a secret
Yeah,
tiny group. I think
the
people are just responding. I agree with you 100%. People are in power or just responding to incentives. So what are your thoughts on the viability of alternative institutions such as in economics and finance or education?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, part of, the last few years is kind of an exploding of possibilities with tech, and especially in the last year or so, both, the importance of homeschooling or local schooling since schools have been closed, and considering what schools are turning into, plenty of people don't even want to go back now that they're open. So I think that alternative institutions, and I've started writing about this, I'm going to write far more formally in the future, is, you need institutions that are robust. And what I mean by robust is that the members of the institution have to feel a higher loyalty to each other than to really anything else. And the problem is that it's very, very difficult to find those kinds of people. And the people who are like that tend to just be in a religious order. They're a monk or a nun somewhere. It's very difficult to find that. And so, kind of the loss, ironically, of like an honor culture, now means that it's very difficult to build institutions, but it's not impossible. And I think that especially over the last few years, it's become more people are becoming more open to different responding to different kinds of incentives. And so I think that, what you're looking at is you're looking at local institutions, local education, and really like decentralized finance is something that I find very interesting. It's not necessarily a new idea, which gives it a greater amount of legitimacy in my eyes. I mean, there are decentralized local financial institutions even in the United States right now. I mean, there's mutual credit organizations in a number of northeastern states. I mean,
Like with
decent
religious
finance.
groups, Mormons,
Yeah,
Orthodox Jews,
exactly. And
immigrant
so,
diasporas.
there's these systems exist, and I think that one of the most important things you can do is really, build more of these kinds of local institutions that help people escape from, these two big things, the economic side and the what's it called? The education side. I mean, I think that, it's going to require a degree of communal operation on a local scale that, I think it's so difficult because there's so many structural forces working against it. But when I say it really truly is the only way, like I wrote about this just recently, is you're not going to take over an institution. You're just not. Like, you will be neutered over the course of years via a thousand tiny compromises.
That's another flaw of the right, is conservatives have always been about winning electorally, but they've never really
Yeah.
considered institutional power.
I mean, and this is, I wrote about this as well, is like, the Battle of Saratoga during the United States Revolution was incredibly critical, not because upstate New York is the most important battlefield out there, but because it proves to the French that we were worth supporting. It was the French were like, we're not going to dump millions of, or I guess in today's money, billions of dollars into these upstart random, mountain people across the ocean just to get back at the British and then lose all of that. We're not going to do that. We're only going to do it if it helps us cut a huge source of power away from the British. And they're watching and they're like, well, these guys probably are going to lose. And then there was this battle that were like, okay, they've proved themselves. They are worthy of my patronage. I mean, when you look at these political, actors, they're strategic. They're not going to just align themselves out of the goodness of their heart. They're going to look at you and they're going to go, what support are you going to give me? I mean, that's really what a ruler does. It says, I give you material benefits and you give me support. And how do you prove that you have that support without an institutional backing? And you don't. So, you know, the Donald Trump was a weak president because he was subsumed by the party because he had no institutional backing. You know, and so President Trump looked nothing like candidate Trump. And, you know, the action and the rhetoric did not match. You know, I mean, like, you need to build that institutional power and you need to align it in such a way that it's very much wielded mercilessly. I mean, politicians are not going to learn until they start getting voted out. You know, it's not going to happen. I mean, and you can do this on a local level pretty easily. I mean, local turnout is pitiful. You know, there's so many inefficiencies and gaps to be exploited in the American political system, and a lot of it can be done. And so, you know, again, I focus on the local and I focus on alternative institutions. And from there, like, I won't necessarily refer to it as being wholly bottom up, but you're going to end up generating institutions that become aligned with each other and generate their own new elites. And those new elites will be able to have power to challenge the systems that are almost just destroying what makes life worth living today.
That does kind of tie in with pan-enclavism, and it does call for autonomy on a group level. It's not against individual rights, but it's against identity based on radical individualism, and it accepts that all politics is identity politics. But I guess it's a sort of, I don't know if I want to use the word right-wing, but it is a sort of right-wing multiculturalism. And pan-enclavism, it's an alternative to both civic nationalism and the kind of more kind of LARPy like forms of ethnic-based nationalism that are not going to go anywhere. Yep. So it's incorporating aspects of multiculturalism from the left. So it's multiculturalism where whites can take part, but at the same time, it is accepting that multiculturalism is inevitable, which the right is extremely uncomfortable with, where you have like an individual town that's more it's more homogenous as part of this, but it's part of a greater, more diverse, multi-ethnic, multicultural patchwork. So even some kind of lefty types like Norman Mailer or Jane Jacobs were kind of sympathetic to this back in the 60s. And it is critical for economic opportunities and the balance of power.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that we agree on almost entirely. You know, Jane Jacobs referred to a healthy city as being a federation of neighborhoods. You know, and that's it's a pretty big theme in new urbanist theory. You know, the idea that you have these connected parts, but the parts are themselves fairly, you know, they're their own things. You know, and so I wouldn't necessarily refer to that as right wing per se, you know, as much as just kind of like a different understanding of where autonomy lies.
What is,
you know,
it's towns, for like it's for freedom of association that
at a
the
community
left
level.
Like the left is in its current form is opposed to any community that is homogeneously white or European.
Yes.
But at the same time, it is accepting that we are part of this multicultural framework. And I think the right wants to keep fighting that. And then basically, I think both from like from the more kind of Fox News conservatives to the more extreme like white nationalist types, they want to fight against diversity, but they're not going anywhere. You kind of have to make peace with it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so like I'm Native American, and one of the things that I always have felt, it's not something that you vocalize in pleasant company necessarily, but like there is an extent to which, you know, being in a Northeastern tribe that has no land, that has no very little cohesion left, largely because it has no land, is that, you know, there's definitely a feeling of being robbed of understanding your heritage, certainly. And so I think that, you know, in the same way, and I think we agree entirely, I think I came at it, you know, from the Jane Jacobs left-wing kind of side, which is, you know, even in New York City, like, you have neighborhoods that are much more homogeneous, but it's in part of a very, very diverse city. I think
tribalism is, in various parts of the world, like Africa, South Asia, the Middle East, like, tribalism is the norm, and the kind of liberalism that wants to force everyone, that wants to erode that and kind of abolish freedom of association and force everyone to share the same mass society and centralized institution.
Yeah,
it's quasi-imperialist.
I mean, I referred to this as, you know, the homogenization of spaces, which is that every town looks the same, you know, or it's the same restaurants,
like it's
the same demographics, everything, and there's no uniqueness. There's nothing there to look for. I mean, I think that a very strong part of, or a very big part of the of this push on the left is a very strong feeling that, and it's a correct one, it's an observation more than a feeling, but economic opportunity or even just the opportunity to have anything resembling a decent life is very unequally distributed geographically across this country. Not just income wise, you know, but, you know, some towns are, you know, they look like bombed out hell holes. I mean, you know, it looks like they could have been at war 15 years ago. You know, it's not just, this isn't just impacting minority neighborhoods. I mean, the entire Rust Belt is just a travesty. And, you know, I think that there is a feeling that people need freedom of movement for the fact that people need, you know, the ability to live a good life. And, you know, I think that the response to this is that, you know, you need a level of community or communal self-determination. You know, you need people to say, okay, like, my community has a character. And like, I'm going to be honest with you, I don't particularly care how people define that character.
Yeah, like, I'm totally for freedom of association, but I think the right, this is another thing I strongly dislike about most of the American right, is they're saying they're against diversity and multiculturalism because it's causing division. I think we should embrace diversity and having communities that are unique and distinct. The main reason I'm strongly opposed to the left and the kind of corporate establishment, because they're against diversity. Their values and political system is leading to this mass homogenization.
Yeah, it's not diversity that causes the problems. It's homogenization. It's the fact that everything gets smashed together instead of saying, okay, like, everything needs a space. All right, it needs a place. There's a commons, there's a common area, there's a common place, but, like, everything needs its own space. It needs a place in society.
Yeah, you need that balance, and it's the same with urban planning. Like, regardless, there's this whole debate about density, whether we should have skyscrapers or single, or more kind of rural areas of villages, but regardless, the commons are the most crucial, regardless of urbanism. And a lot of suburbs, you have a street with retail, restaurants or fast food or whatever, and then you have residential, and there's like a lacking of any commons.
Yeah, I mean,
and,
you know,
pan-enclavism would incorporate that.
Yeah, I mean, my big problem with the YIMBY movement is my big disagreement with, like, this vulgar productivism. It's like, just build more. There's no question of are we building in a healthy manner or an unhealthy manner. There's just these very basic, like, well, it'll decrease carbon emissions per capita by some amount, supposedly, and, you know, it'll bring housing prices down. There's no engagement in those deeper questions of, is it building a healthier society or building a more atomized and unhealthy one. And so I think that, you know, there's good density, and then there's bad density. There's good urbanism and bad urbanism. Bad urbanism is not just sprawl. It's like building beyond the human scale.
I think
scale.
Beyond, there's this obsession of density against low density, but I think both sides have the same problems.
Oh, yeah.
You could have a low density area that's like these villages that are high in social capital, but there's like semi-rural to ex-urban areas that are, they're totally atomized, and you could have dense
villages,
urban area that's fantastic,
oh, yeah.
And an urban area that's atomized. I think both density and low density can have positive, and then they can have the same problems.
Yeah, well, different forms of the same problems. You see different kinds of atomization in rural areas than in urban ones. But, like, you know, I mean, I think that there's a return to kind of, like, the hub city or the hub village and people all being within walkable distance of it. You know, I mean, there's a lot of different levels of density that can have healthy urbanism or healthy networks, but, you know, it's the general problem is building beyond the human scale, you know, and kind of forgetting what it means to live in a healthy society, all in pursuit of some economic optimization.
With this theme of post-Americanism, which you have in your handle, I think doesn't mean that America is guaranteed to break up into smaller countries. There are independence movements, but what it basically means is that America will exist as a political and economic unit, but the ideology of Americanism is dying out.
Yeah, more specifically, that America was founded as a liberal nation. That America, that is what America is, liberalism right now. I mean, certainly you could make an argument, it's debatable, but you could make an argument that at some point America was a blood and soil nation. I don't think that's true. I think that the sheer size of America meant that different nations really built up, and ignoring even, I mean, people were loyal to their states more than the nation, you know, until really the Civil War, and we're ignoring the entire problem or issue of white and black relations as well, and how that fits into the nation. So, But you know, certainly you can make that argument. I mean, even if that existed, it's gone. It's been gone for generations. It's not coming back. I think that part of the right and part of what's frustrating about the right is this vision that largely a romanticized vision of this blood and soil nation that they want back. And, you know, the problem is it never existed in the first place. And you're never getting it back. You know, it's, and that's, you know, it's like, okay, like the world isn't ending because of that. So I think that, you know, with the idea of post-America is, you know, abandon the acceptance of liberalism, abandon that and understand, like, okay, there are multiple little, you know, groups of, there's really multiple nations within America, and like, that's fine.
Yeah,
but, like, understand that America
is like one neighborhood could function as like a micronation.
Yeah, you know, and that's kind of one of the reasons why I found your work very interesting. I think we resonate with each other, and you know, it's understanding that America is an internal empire. That's what it is. It's not a nation. It's, you know, and it's fine for it to be an internal empire. I mean,
it's
ironically probably
more post-Americanism as an ideology. It's not anti-Americanism. It's just saying,
yeah, it's not
that accepting that we're not a traditional
ironically, it may very well be more trad than most of these markers, because,
like,
you know,
the
it's
Ottomans, the Byzantines,
the articles of confess. Well, no, not even just that, but even within America, it's like prior to the Civil War. I mean, people did not. You know, it wasn't really a thing to think of ourselves as one nation. I mean, that was very much an intention.
Yeah, that's not even like a new phenomenon because of new waves of immigrants. Even in colonial times, you had different, like Albion Sea, like the Puritans,
yep,
the Cavaliers,
yep,
different groups,
yep,
that were kind of at odds. We're getting close to the end of the show. I think one last thing I want to ask you is, yep. Do you think, you said get woke, go broke as a cope. Do you think another characteristic of the post-right is calling everything a cope? And do you think a lot of dissident and online politics is a cope to fulfill a certain psychological need?
Yes. Yes. I actually, funny enough, wrote about that just recently. But, you know, basically the idea, I think that the title is The LARPing Will Continue Until Morale Improves. And really, you know, there's this idea of playing a LARP as being almost intellectually or emotionally sedating. And I think that you have a system in which you have people kind of taking what would be energy used to rebel against the system and kind of putting it into a simulation of the world in their head and playing these roles that are detached from reality and but are treated as to butcher Baudrillard, I can't pronounce anything, Baudrillard, realer than real, you know, these simulations, these games. And you know, I think that what it comes down to is it comes down to actually building things. I mean, you know, the acquiring clout is no different than, you know, being one of those NGOs that raises awareness.
In some cases, some people online, they lack the economic wealth and the social capital to build anything, so they kind of rely upon copes. But it's important to be able to psychologically differentiate between the two. It's okay to engage in intellectual endeavors, but to differentiate between what's a cope and what's hypothetical, and then what is what's actually something you can build that's tangible.
And I mean, you know, my big thing is like, you can build social capital. I mean, there is something to be said about going out, shaking hands, exchanging smiles. I mean, you know, I think that any dissident movement needs a lot fewer theorists and a lot more salespeople. You know, like there's a degree of cope in there, sure, in terms of the theory and the roles that people play, but it is important to guide. But like what really needs to happen for any dissident movement, whether it's a post-liberal left, a post-right, whatever you want to call it, neither left nor right, alt-centrism, apexism, whatever, any kind of movement that's seeking to change the established order is going to need to convince large numbers of people to go along with it. And you do that in the same way that sports teams gain loyalty. You do that by winning. You do that by demonstrating competence. You can do that on a local level. Like I scratch your back, you scratch mine, I can do something for you. And, you know, you can do it on a regional level. You can do it on a national level. Like, here is a product, and in exchange for you using the product, you know, you pay me, and you know, you've established a network, and you know, all of these kinds of things, like building systems, or even just you know, again, like going out and talking about things with people. And this is important. It's important to kind of, especially, you know, I think that we're in a very important period. We are in a crisis. You know, and I don't believe in never-ending crises. Crises are more than just government policy. They're historical moments that allow for an opening of possibility, because a lot of the beliefs kind of are you know, there's a widespread disillusionment, and I think that's happened, and I think that all of the polls and everything, all of the discussions, the discourse play that out. But you need to actually like engage with the with real people in the real world. You need to build things, and you know, it is time to build. It's not time to build rocket ships and skyscrapers and space elevators. It's time to build institutions that can become power bases to shift things. And you know, I think that we are on a terminal, not necessarily a terminal, but we're on a very sharp decline. I think that we're going a lot faster than people expect us to, and I don't foresee good things coming out of that. I think that if we want to arrest that decline or build, you know, you got to build an off ramp, and that off ramp has to be strong enough and sturdy enough and it also has to be gradual enough to allow a speeding car to get off. You know, and so how do you do that? And there are ways to do it. And so that's where I think that those alternative institutions come in. And it's why sell the product to people and start building that actual power base. I mean, you know, listen, none of us are perfect at everything. And I can't build a DeFi application, the decentralized finance one, but I'm working on homeschooling stuff. I mean, that's something that I can do. And so find what you can do and start building things. You know, that's really all there is to it at the end of the day. We can launch as many podcasts as we want, but what comes down to it is boots on the ground. And, you know, that makes or breaks the movement. So that's, you know, alternative institutions is the future, or there is no future.
We're at the end of the show. Before I wrap up, do you want to plug your appearances on a number of podcasts, including Breaking the Rules, which has Gio Panicchietti, who I had on this podcast, Alex Kachuta, and the South African YouTuber Conscious Caracol, and then any other upcoming projects that you want to plug?
Yeah, I have a couple magazine articles in the works, one of which will discuss very similar themes to this podcast. So I can't release the names, but certainly we'll be sharing it when it comes out. You know, I blog at apexisnotes.substack.com. I try to post about 2-3 times a week. But yeah, I mean, thank you, Robert, for the conversation. I really appreciate you bringing me on and taking the time to do this. So, you know, I had a really nice time talking. I think that we resonate a lot of things. Hope to have more of these conversations in the future.
Apex, great show. Check out his Substack. Thanks for being on.
Thank you.